And then, 100 yards away, something small and black burst from the sea. A bird, fluttering its wings, and then rising into the sky, making a turn, and heading finally toward the west. A raven. A breeze stirred. A sail flapped lazily, and then another. The captain spun on the deck, shouting orders, and the men began climbing into the rigging. They were underway. To America. Part 4. The New York Morning. They smelled the land before they saw it, a rich, dark odor of sweet earth coming at them through a misty rain. Then seabirds appeared, crying and screeing. Cormac was on deck, his hair and beard trimmed, his new brown suit and long blue coat fashioned by Mr. Partridge, who had refused his money. Then a dark line spread across the horizon, and there was a huge cheer and waving of hats. The land on the right was the Long Island. Dutch farms are scattered over much of it, Mr. Partridge said, along with their slaves. And then up ahead, rising from the sea, there was a small mountain, like the island where Mary Morrigan had waved goodbye. Staten Island, Mr. Partridge said. It'll be to port as we turn into the Narrows. Now remember all I told you, lad. We have much to do together. He had given Cormac the address on Stone Street of a place called Hewson's, where he might rent a room while Mr. Partridge looked for a place for his print shop. Mr. Partridge himself would be staying at the Black Horse Tavern, run by friends, booked long ago. Cormac should call on him once a day, that was the plan, and Mr. Partridge would tell him of his progress. He had given Cormac a crudely printed map of the town, along with a litany of dire warnings. "The most dangerous of the lot are the ones who now think they're respectable," he had said. "They go to church, they wear fine clothes, they use snuff, and they'd steal the eyeballs out of your head. Still and all, they'll give us much to print." As soon as Mr. Partridge found a place for his press, he would teach Cormac the printing trade. Now the fury moved toward New York. As a new breeze ruffled Cormac's hair, a feeling blossomed within him, nurtured by the smell of the American earth. In some way, he wanted to kill the Earl in order to live on. At last the emigrants were released to the freedom of the deck, blinking and trembling. Tears streaked the grime on some women's faces, but they could not even manage a sob. They gazed at Brooklyn as if it were the seacoast of the moon. Manhattan grew larger and more clear, a fort at the tip. The captain guided them into the East River. They saw other ships tied up at timbered piers. Directly before them on shore was a large, empty, tin-roofed shed. Beneath the roof, an elevated stage. "That tin-roofed building," Mr. Partridge said, "is the slave market." Cormac thought, "This is where Congo will be sold. But not Tamora. She has escaped." Ropes were thrown, knots tied to stanchions. The Reverend Clifford was now on deck. He was dressed in black, his eyes dead. The captain offered the top-deck passengers his thanks and his apologies for the rigors of the journey. He wished them good luck and gestured toward the wide plank leading to the wharf. Mr. Partridge and Cormac walked down to the land. There were no policemen or soldiers waiting with lists, and Cormac took a deep breath and exhaled slowly. Then, to Cormac, it was as if the land were tilting and shifting, and some in the crowd laughed as they wobbled and lurched and tried to turn sea legs into land legs. Mr. Partridge found a stevedore with a large cart who promised to deliver his press to Van Zandt's warehouse 3 blocks to the south. But Mr. Partridge didn't trust its safe portage without being with it every minute. They waited together, with the stevedore off to the side. Now the emigrants were tottering down the wide plank, looking like the risen crew of a death ship. A few of them were free men and rushed to collapse into the arm of some relative. The rest were herded toward a brawny man in a leather vest who waited at the bottom of the plank, with an African holding an umbrella over his head. Each emigrant gave a name, and the burly man checked them off a list and pointed to a space in the rain to the left of the slave market where they must wait. A huge black man detached himself from a group of agents and stood with the Irish, a leather whip curled in his huge hand. Cormac heard some of the stevedores call his name, Kwako. At last, 9 Africans were brought up on deck, with Congo in the lead. With gestures and scowls, the boss beckoned them forward. His lieutenants tensed as if ready to drag them ashore. Kwako watched from a distance. Congo obviously calculated the odds of escape, and they were too long. Then he led the way down the plank. The African stood very still on the flagstones along the edge of the pier. The boss agent said something and pointed to the stage of the slave market. The slave with the umbrella translated for his boss, but Congo didn't move. The biggest of the private guards hammered Congo on the back with the butt of the long gun. Cormac rushed in.
"Wait," he shouted. "Don't do that. Can a man with a broken head be sold?"
An English soldier suddenly appeared, his lip curled.
"What's all this?"
"Nothing,"
Cormac said, afraid now of an arrest. With a shrug and a turn of the head, Cormac urged Congo to go along. Kwako was staring at both of them. He nodded at Congo. Congo took a deep breath and led the way to the stage of the market. Then Mr. Partridge returned from his tasks, his face wet, his eyes angry. From a distance, he had seen Cormac's small intervention.
"Are you mad? They could have arrested you. They are shameless monsters, the lot of them."
A short time later, it was all settled on the quay at the foot of Wall Street. The huge crate was safely stored in Van Zandt's warehouse. Mr. Partridge and Cormac walked up the slope of Wall Street, heading west, and the crowds filled Cormac with a sense of the marvelous. Here were all the nations of the earth, their languages drifting through the soggy air. Cormac felt that he had entered the main street of Babel. New York was an English town, of course, and had been one since 1673, the second time the English took it from the Dutch at gunpoint, Mr. Partridge said, the way they'd taken Ireland from the Irish. Cormac now noticed how many Africans there were in the streets.
"They're a fifth of the population, lad," Mr. Partridge explained, "a fifth out of 11,000 souls."
To Cormac, they seemed part of the burly-burly of the street. He wondered if Congo would become just another one of them. There were black women, too. They didn't resemble Tamora. Most were in the company of white women, carrying their bundles from the shops or packages of meat from the market. As they walked, Mr. Partridge tried to fill Cormac with the lore of the place. They stopped again at the corner of Broad Street and Wall.
"That immense steeple up ahead," he told Cormac, "is Trinity Church. It rises 175 feet into the air."
Cormac was astonished. This was the tallest structure he'd ever seen. Mr. Partridge hissed.
"It's just another attempt by the bloody Church of England to impose itself on people who are not in the least bit interested."
Across the street, the three-story building was the City Hall.
"Look quickly," he said. "It's sure to get bigger and grander in the blink of an eye."
They turned into Broad Street. Mr. Partridge paused at the entrance to the Black Horse, where he would stay. He pointed Cormac down the wide, crowded avenue toward Stone Street.
"And don't eat anything sold in the street," he shouted in farewell. "That'll kill you faster than the voyage."
Broad Street was unpaved, widening out as it moved away from Wall Street, with a shimmer of harbor light at its distant end. Dozens of motionless carts and wagons were engulfed by customers, shouting and bargaining with peddlers. Cormac passed a bank, tobacconist, a button maker, and more carts, and finally reached Stone Street. The cobblestone street sloped down toward the wooden stockade walls of Fort George. On the ramparts, he could see the shiny peaked caps of soldiers, slashes of scarlet. At the bottom of the street was the tavern run by John Hewson. The house was three stories high with sloping eaves and a chimney at the back. There was a careless quality to it. He knocked on the door, waited a long while. The door was jerked open, and he was startled by the woman who stood before him. Sharp, beaked nose, a slash of mouth.
"Is it a room you want?" she said.
"Aye."
"Are you Irish?"
"Aye."
"Are you Catholic?"
"No."
"3 shillings a week, meals included, in advance. Do you have money?"
"Aye."
"Come in, and don't be clomping them boots on our nice dry floors."
He sat on a bench, unlaced the boots, peeled off the socks. The stairs creaked, and he looked up and saw a young woman's bare calves first, and then the rest of her. Dark brown hair, sullen eyes, full lips, small waist. She inspected him in a chilly way.
"This is Mary Burton," the older woman said to Cormac. "Your name is?"
"O'Donovan," Cormac said. "Martin O'Donovan, from Galway."
Good. I'm Sarah Hewson. I run this place with my husband, John. Mary, take Mr. O'Donovan to room 3, would you, dearie?
He dug 3 shillings from his pocket and handed them to the older woman. Then he followed Mary Burton up the stairs, eyes fixed on her bare calves. She led him to a small room under the eaves.
Well, you're certainly not from Galway, she said. Not with that accent. I'm from Galway, so I assume your name's not Martin O'Donovan.
Is there a way to get a bit of breakfast? He asked.
First take off your clothes, she said.
He laughed. Is this the way you welcome people to America?
No, it's just that I can't stand the feckin' sight of that lovely feckin' suit turning into a feckin' coal bag. And besides, I want to know what it is you've got strapped to your back.
He removed his jacket and hung it on the bedpost. It's a sword, Cormac said. My father's sword. She looked at him with a kind of disbelief. He sensed that there were few stories that Mary Burton truly believed. She lifted his jacket off the bedpost. A sour odor filled the room. Cormac was sure it was from him.
The trousers, too.
I don't know you that well, miss. I don't...
The name's Mary Burton. I owe the feckin' Hewson 6 more feckin' years on me feckin' indenture. Let me have the feckin' trousers.
Why don't you fetch me some breakfast, and I'll take them off and put them out while you're gone.
Jesus, another tight nutter from Ireland.
She hustled out with the jacket, closing the door behind her. Later, he shoved his bag between bed and wall, with the small leather pouch inside containing his mother's spiral earrings. He laid the sword under the thin mattress and strapped the money belt to the small of his back. The rain whipped the window panes, and he fell asleep. In the dark, Cormac heard the muffled sound of a fiddle and thought he was still on the ship. He rubbed his eyes, and the room emerged dimly. His suit was not in the room. He cracked open the door, and there was the suit, neatly hanging on a rough hanger hooked upon a wall peg opposite the door. He dressed and followed the sound of the fiddle down 2 flights of stairs to the blue door in the back of the entrance hall. He opened the door and stepped into another world. A low-ceilinged, smoky room crowded with white men and Africans, some of them up and jigging madly to the music. Mary Burton, all rosy in the light of lanterns, came over and grabbed Cormac's forearm.
The feckin' suit looks better now.
She jerked him into the center of the dancing men, her back straight, her arms rigidly hanging at her side, her breasts bouncing to the music and the movements. The room roared.
Dance it, Merrymouth! Do it! Do it!
She glowered at Cormac until he stepped in and tried to match her moves, feeling clumsy, his legs like lumber. Until one of the Africans shouted at him,
"Don't think, boy. Move!"
And so he did, surrendering to the music and the packed heat and the smoke and the open mouth of Mary Burton, her lips shifting as he stared, and the music pulsing and her breasts pushing against the cotton blouse. And she was Mary Morrigan, and she was Bridget Riley, and his head started seething, and he felt himself hardening, and her hand brushed his hardness while the other dancers bumped against him. And then it was over. Everyone cheered. Mary Burton embraced him, pressing into him, pushing her small breasts hard against his chest.
Ah, that was feckin' grand.
He followed her to the bar, which was covered with jugs and glasses and mugs and platters of ham and venison. She heaped food on a plate. Behind the bar stood a tall, unsmiling, fleshy man.
John, Mary Burton said, this is your new boarder, Mr. O'Donovan.
Hewson's mouth smiled, but his eyes were soft and disappointed.
Welcome, he said. Have a drink, lad. Maybe you'll be the one to land Miss Mouth.
Come on, Mary Burton said, grabbing Cormac's plate and pushing him along to a table near the far wall. 3 black men were seated on a bench, drinking rum.
Move over, you lot,
Mary Burton said, and they did, smiling and polite.
We've got us a new feckin' inmate.
Cormac had already seen one of them, Quaco, at the Wall Street Quay that morning. He gave Cormac a look of recognition, perhaps remembering that he had tried to protect Congo. The others were named Sandy and Diamond. Mary Burton turned her back to them and picked at some food on Cormac's plate.
Why do they call you Merrymouth? He asked. Because of me dirty feckin' mouth. John Hewson says I've got the dirtiest feckin' mouth in America.
Cormac squeezed her hand.
Well, there are a lot worse things, I suppose.
Aye, like being a feckin' slave. They call it indentured servants,
but that's the fancy way to say it. The true feckin' word is slave, just like all these black fellas from Africa. I told John, you might own me, but you won't have me body and don't expect me to act like a feckin' lady while I do the slave work. She smiled. Drives him feckin' wicked, it does.
She got up and went to the bar and carried plates to another table and sat down again with Cormac, talking and moving to the music, and then was up again. Across the night, she explained in bits and pieces this small part of the world into which he had arrived. Cormac learned that Hewson's was one of only four taverns where blacks and whites mixed freely. The British authorities didn't like it, but they took Hewson's little bribes and left him alone. Cormac heard that first night from Mary, from Quacko, with nods and mutterings from Diamond and sad remarks from Sandy, what he would hear for many weeks to come. For the Africans, New York was getting worse, not better.
They see too many of us now, Quacko said quietly. They need us, but they fears us too.
There's sure to be a day, Diamond said, staring at his rum. There's sure to be a day, our day. Shut down, fool, Quacko said, and playfully squeezed Diamond's head and sipped his own porter.
But as the night lengthened, Quacko's tongue was loosened by drink. He told Cormac what it was like to be a slave in New York. Slaves couldn't ever confront a master. If they did, they got the lash. Sometimes they got the lash for no reason.
Africa man can't go to school to learn to read, cause they might read newspapers and see stories about slaves who murder their masters. Like we don't know. Like we don't hear.
Sell us, trade us, rent us, Diamond murmured. There's sure to be a day.
Mary Burton heard this fragment of talk and said,
Explain about the great God-fearing, dog-feckin' piss-drinking Christian churches.
Slaves couldn't get married in any Christian church, so they had their own ceremonies.
I marry my wife here in Hewson's, said Quacko, and for the first time his eyes looked bitter. My wife, she work in the fort. They won't let me see her at night. She have to sneak out and go with me in the trees, like the white horse by the fort. My wife, and they own her.
Mary Burton put a calming hand on Quacko's forearm and turned to Cormac.
In other words, these poor buggers are treated like we was treated in the feckin' old country.
Quacko jerked his arm free and headed to the back door. Diamond and Sandy hurried after him, and the three of them passed into the New York darkness. Mary Burton explained one other truth about the tavern to Cormac. The Africans didn't just come here for the drink and the freedom. They were there every night of the week because John Hewson was a fence.
If you're a slave, she said, the law is a feckin' joke, and so most of them are thieves.
Hewson didn't often give cash to the Africans. What he gave them was credit in his own tavern. Mary's rebellion, what she did for pride, was a simpler matter. Hewson owned her but could not have her. This year's whore was Peggy, who arrived one snowy midnight from Newfoundland and never left. Mary motioned toward a young woman across the room, red-haired, thick-breasted, broad-shouldered, and large. Peggy slept with the Africans if they had the money in cash. The back door opened. A large black man bent his head under the doorframe.
That's Caesar. I'm sure he's put a child in poor dumb Peggy. He's a dangerous fecker.
At one point, two African women came in and joined two white men at a table. The women were tall, dressed in American clothes, with bonnets on their heads. One of them had neat scars on both cheeks, arranged in rows, and wore gold hoops in her ears. Tamora's face moved in Cormac. Full lips, lush body in a shroud on a windless sea.
You've got lust in your face, Mary Burton said. Do you want one of them?
No, Cormac lied.
You can have either one for a few shillings, she said, or both. God knows they need the money.
The women were drinking rum paid for by the white men. One nodded at Caesar, the obvious ponce.
Whatever they get, he gets half. Do you want one? Mary Burton whispered.
I want you, Cormac said. She squeezed his thigh in a playful way and got up.
I'm too old for you, she said.
In Cormac's 3 weeks at Hewson's, each day he'd pay a visit to Mr. Partridge at the Black Horse to hear about the search for a shop. The other hours were Cormac's, and he used them to search for the Earl of Warren. Cormac had learned that a man could walk all of the New York streets in a single day. Most of the time he was on his own, wandering in the mornings down to the battery, where four squat cannon were aimed at the harbor, fearful of the Pope's imminent arrival on board a Spanish warship. The various Christian rivers flowed through the streets of New York. Quakers quaking, Congregationalists congregating, Baptists baptizing, Dutch reformers reforming, Episcopalians pissing on the lot. At the common, all asked for money to support the war against evil. Only the proud, haughty Anglicans of Trinity were not present on the street, since they were supported by taxpayer money and had no need to panhandle for God. Most New Yorkers paid the preachers little heed. Blacks were not welcome among the small knots of fevered religiosos. Then, on the second Sunday after his arrival, he saw a familiar face among the preachers on the common. He was gaunt, his clothes dirty and crumpled, his boots muddy. He was holding the Old Testament, mumbling to those who passed.
"She's dead," said the Reverend Clifford. "She's dead. She's dead."
Cormac backed away in horror and slipped into a side street. Twice, Cormac pushed beyond the city's northern border. He found his way to the collect pond and walked around its edges. The collect was no small body of water. It was 60 feet deep, more spring-fed lake than simple pond. At dawn, men scraped its bottom for oysters. At dusk, they trolled in rowboats for bass. It was the primary source of the city's water. Each day, cartmen hired by the city heaved unburned garbage into the pond. A hill rose abruptly at the southern edge, bald and craggy and vaguely sinister. On this hill, Cormac was told, the hangman plied his trade. From the peak of the hill, he could see the island rolling north into thick forests sliced with the silver lines of streams. He knew that he would never find the Earl in the fields and forests above the town, but they pulled at him in some mysterious way, filling him with memories of Ireland. In the city, he was often in the company of Mr. Partridge as he searched for a place where he could house his printing press, himself, and Cormac, his apprentice. Along the way, Cormac got to know him better, and liked him even more.
"How do they get away with it?"
he said to Cormac as they walked down Broad Street one hot and sticky July afternoon.
"How do they get armies to carry their stupid flags and march off to die? That's the mystery. How do they get to sit on a throne in court, dressed in silks and lace and powdered wigs, and get intelligent men to kneel before them, in awe, in bloody supplication?"
Such words would have been treasonous to most of His Majesty's loyal subjects in New York. But Mr. Partridge was also a careful man. He only spoke his Republican thoughts to Cormac when there was not another soul in earshot. And so it went as they wandered the town. Mr. Partridge didn't always rant about cabbages and kings. He fed Cormac's mind with geography and history. When he pointed across the East River at Brooklyn, he knew that the other island was 118 miles long. "That's why they call it the Long Island," he said. "Brilliant bit of naming, isn't it?" The East River itself wasn't a river at all. It was an estuary, with one side running north, the other side south, and a great dangerous place at the top of the estuary called Hell Gate. And yet there was a simple reason for docking ships here on the East River instead of the North River. The island protected them from the western winds. "The winters are brutal here," Mr. Partridge said, "and the summers are worse. Spring is very short, because water coming down the North River is still very cold. October is the best month, but the air is never dry. Still, it's a perfect place to build a town, because of that harbor. Mark my words, New York will end up bigger than Boston and Philadelphia combined." This was not easy for Cormac to believe as they wandered through the low, cramped town, the town of shining horses and rooting pigs, but Mr. Partridge loved it. "Water's the big problem now," he said, "and the town can't grow until it's solved." Water came from a single well on Broadway because the collect was too far out in the wilderness.
"But look at all these signs, lad," the older man said. "They're going to feed the two of us."
Posters adorned many walls, advertising dentists and writing teachers, elocutionists and dancing masters, goods freshly arrived from England or taken by some privateer. In the shops or on the streets, Cormac began seeing Africans who'd passed through Hewson's, working as tinners and carpenters, butchers and handlers of horses, and they exchanged subtle nods of recognition. Cormac kept seeing them as runaways, moving through the green forests to the north of the island. In his mind, he saw Congo too, wherever he was, getting ready to run. On his second Friday evening at Hewson's, Cormac dined on ham and roasted potatoes at the bar, then passed through the blue door and climbed the stairs to his room. The door was unlocked. When he stepped inside, Mary Burton was pouring hot water into the tub.
"Get in while it's hot."
She paused, looking at him.
"Tonight, I'll join you if you don't mind. I want you to take off me clothes, and then squeeze the loneliness out of me."
On the Friday morning of his third week in New York, everything changed. Cormac was finishing breakfast in the quiet bar at Hewson's when Mary Burton appeared, a sheet of paper in her hand.
"It's for you,"
she said. He saw Mr. Partridge's handwriting.
"Pack your bags and come at once. I've found a place."
Cormac thought, at last I can leave Hewson's and be in my own small piece of New York, doing work, learning a trade. He glanced up and Mary Burton's eyes were drilling holes in his skull.
"So you're leaving," she said.
"Leaving here, but not leaving New York, Mary. I'll be back."
"Oh, just go without the feckin' blather."
He packed his things quickly and strapped the sword to his hip, letting it show. Downstairs, Cormac opened the door to the New York Morning. He turned to say goodbye to Mary Burton, but she was climbing the stairs. And so he entered the printing trade. Mr. Partridge had found an unused former stable on Cortland Street, over by the North River. The space was dark and cobwebbed, reeking of ancient shit and rotting vegetable matter. High up in the back, he saw the trace of a ladder rising to a second-floor loft. Behind them, the double doors on the Cortland Street side were immense, built for carriages. A smaller door opened into the muddy backyard. Cormac was appalled, but Mr. Partridge saw the place with other eyes, the same eyes that gazed at New York, seeing it for what it could become, not for what it was. Cormac went to work scrubbing the flagstones. His breath quickened when he saw the first blue-gray quarried stone beneath the brown fibrous carpet, and he worked almost frantically to uncover each of its buried brothers. Mr. Partridge vanished for a few hours, returning with bread and beef and water, and two Africans who carried in a pair of cots that he'd bought. One cot was for Cormac, and they parked it beside the fireplace. The Africans carried the second cot up the ladder to the loft where Mr. Partridge would live. On Saturday morning, he was back again at the stones, scraping, washing, polishing. Meanwhile, two Norwegian ship's carpenters arrived and went immediately to work building a platform upon which the press would stand. As Cormac and Mr. Partridge filled chinks in the stone walls with cement and erected rope lines from which paper could be hung by pegs, the Norwegians swiftly fashioned shelves for paper and ink and type. By Monday morning, all was ready for the arrival of the press. At a few minutes after 8, it appeared on the back of a horse-drawn wagon from Van Zandt's warehouse, still in its huge crate. Two black men eased the crate on rollers into the backyard, then opened it carefully. On the floor of the crate beneath the press was a long, smaller crate.
"Type," Mr. Partridge said. "Without type, we print nothing."
He asked the Africans to carry the box of type inside, then the printing press itself. They positioned the press on its fresh new altar. As they finished, one of the Africans looked at Cormac with recognition in his eyes.
"Hewson's?" Cormac said.
"Yeah."
"Can you do me a favor? I'm looking for a man, an African, a friend. His name is Congo. If you see him, tell him Cormac is looking for him."
"Yeah," he said, and walked off toward the waterfront.
Back inside, Cormac sat beside Mr. Partridge and gazed at the press. It looked to him like some strange giant insect, an immense grasshopper.
"By God," Mr. Partridge whispered, shaking a fist. "We've done it, lad. We're in business."
Not quite. That evening, as they sat on the edge of the platform eating fish and chips, Mr. Partridge's exuberance ebbed.
"Mr. Partridge, you don't seem all right."
"The truth is, lad, I'm almost out of money, and we still need many things here, paper above all, and ink, of course.
Cormac unbuckled his money belt. He handed 10 crowns to Mr. Partridge. The older man looked embarrassed.
No, absolutely not, Mr. Partridge said. You're a boy, an apprentice.
I'm not a boy, Mr. Partridge. I've already killed a man, maybe two. He sketched his story for Mr. Partridge. He revealed his true name and told him everything he could remember about the Earl of Warren and what had happened in Ireland. And when the young man finished, the older man stared at him for a long moment.
How sad, he said finally. How infuriating, and how very sad.
Cormac was relieved that one lie had been removed between himself and Mr. Partridge, the lie of his name. Martin O'Donovan was, for the moment, dead. Cormac Samuel O'Connor was now living here on Cortlandt Street.
Well, Cormac said, we have work to do.
Yes, Mr. Partridge said.
Work.
Mr. Partridge lived in a blur of movement. He set type, pulled proofs, handed them to Cormac to dry. He'd be gone for 2 hours and return with jobs, tax notices, wedding invitations, advertisements for shoes and medicines. He printed anything and everything except posters about escaped slaves. Cormac had no time for Hewson's, but even if he had a few rare empty hours, he stayed away. He thought, what can I tell her? And yet he began to yearn for her. One humid Sunday night in late August, he walked to Stone Street. He stood outside the back door in the darkness. Africans passed him in the dark, entering, departing. Then a familiar face appeared. Kwako.
What you standing here for? He said.
Just getting the night air.
You bad liar, mon.
I miss some people, I suppose.
You mean that little girl Mary, ain't that it?
Kwako slipped inside the tavern. Then the door cracked open, and Mary Burton stepped into the hot night air, closing the door behind her.
What is it you want?
To be saying I'm sorry, Mary, for going off so quick that morning.
Feck off.
She turned to go, and he grabbed her arm.
Mary, listen, please listen. I've been working 18 hours a day. I've been grinding and hauling and pulling in the print shop on Cortlandt Street, and—
Ah, you poor wee lad.
And there's more. I'm looking for a man. A man I'm sworn to find. A man I must kill. I don't want you mixed up in any of this.
She pulled her hand away and folded her arms across her breasts.
I don't believe you, she said. I think you just wanted to be up in me quim and have your fun.
Not true, Mary, he said in a soothing way, pulling her close.
Her arms dropped and he could feel her soften. And then he heard a voice, the door cracking open, Sarah Hewson.
Mary? Are you out there?
Mary kissed him and touched him, and then hurried back into Hewson's, where Africa drummed steadily on gourds and tabletops. The weather turned. He saw his first October in New York, the harbor sparkling, the air crisp and bright. He met Mary Burton one Monday evening, and they made love on the slopes above the Collect. That night he told her his true name. Cormac was working with Mr. Partridge one Saturday noon on 50 large copies of legal advisories when he glanced out the windows. Mary Burton was standing in a doorway, staring into the shop. Then a horse-drawn wagon came by, loaded with crates of dry goods, and when it passed, she was gone. She was trying to send him a message. He was sure of that. That night he went back to Hewson's on Stone Street. The bar was packed, every table filled. Suddenly Mary Burton grabbed his hand.
I must talk with you, she said, Tuesday night on the north end of the common.
She turned away, gathering empty glasses, forcing passage to the bar. Hewson filled a fresh glass and placed it before him. Cormac laid a piece of 8 on the bar. Then Cormac heard the back door open and turned to see the new arrivals. There stood Congo. Behind him were 2 other Africans, both larger than Congo, but it was clear that he was in charge. He was wearing a high-collared blue jacket, a coarse pale blue work shirt, clean baggy trousers, and scuffed boots. In his glance, he told Cormac that he knew him. Congo stepped forward and moved to the bar, next to where Cormac was sipping his porter.
Cormac, he whispered.
Congo,
Cormac responded. Congo tapped a bald fist to his heart and then to Cormac's chest. His friends nodded.
Other blacks watched. The whites tried to look casual. Congo handed mugs of porter to Kwako and his men. A black man came over and bowed his head to Congo, who squeezed his hand. Then another, and still one more. They all said words that Congo accepted as if they were gifts. Kwako saw Cormac watching.
They know Congo has come for them, Kwako said. It is foretold.
Who is he? Asked Cormac.
Kwako sipped his porter.
Babalawo.
A word Cormac didn't know. An African word. Babalawo. That Tuesday, Cormac waited for Mary Burton on a bench at the north end of the common. She was more than an hour late, her eyes jittery. She was quiet for a long while as they watched passing couples and occasional teams of redcoats and carriages carrying rich people to the houses down beyond Wall Street.
There's something going on at Hewson's, she said. The Africans and the Irish together. They're talking about a rising, about striking at the English, about killing people.
She turned to the hill above the common where dead leaves were swirling in the fresh river wind.
Stay away from Hewson's, she said. They're all a-heading for the gallows.
In the frigid winter nights, when Stone Street seemed an immense distance from Cortlandt Street, and it was impossible to meet Mary Burton, Cormac began to draw again. He used the reverse side of over-inked proofs, odd scraps of board, diluted printer's ink, and reed pens. He made drawings of Mr. Partridge, of people he saw in the streets, of soldiers in uniform, and of Mary Burton. Mr. Partridge was delighted.
You've a gift, lad.
Cormac was now so deep into the world of the print shop that other things receded. The images of bloody revolt were threaded in a minor way through his days, but for all the whispered warnings, nothing, after all, had happened. He also brooded in a confused way about Mary Burton. What was it he truly felt for her? Was it simply lust? Or was it something more like that immense word, love? He hoped she was not imagining a future with him, for he had no true vision of that future, or whether he would live long enough to have one. The reason for this uncertainty was the power of the past. Sometimes 3 or 4 days passed, and the Earl of Warren never forced himself into Cormac's mind. But then he would see months-old newspapers from London in the print shop and begin scanning them for the Earl's name, always in vain. But if the Earl was in America, eventually he would come to New York. On some nights, he wondered exactly what Kwako meant when he called Congo a Babalawo. One slow day, he asked Mr. Partridge about the word, and the older man rifled through a fat volume, then shrugged.
It's not in the dictionary, he said, but it could mean a shaman. You know, the kind of witch doctor. Maybe your friend Congo is an African Merlin.
For Cormac, this image was exciting. Congo in Camelot searching for a black grail. He tried to draw the image, but gave up in disgust and tossed the paper into the fireplace. The truth was that all images, including the possibility of riot and fire, were always erased by work. The printing life consumed them. Sometimes Mr. Partridge vanished into the frozen morning off to do business, and Cormac worked on, cleaning and oiling the press. Sometimes he set type himself. In the afternoons, Mr. Partridge returned, bursting with news and gossip and jobs for the shop. Terrible fighting in Jamaica, dreadful cold, the worst winter in New York memory, a shortage of cordwood, trees like iron, blunting the woodsmen's axes. Finally, the night arrived. Sometimes Mr. Partridge carried home a joint or a rib. They dined together, and at such times he was calmer and often spoke obliquely about subjects that never appeared in a newspaper, as he did one night a few days from Christmas.
There's something happening in the town, and I can't put my finger on it, he said. Not just poor sales in the shops, something else, an unease.
The cold got colder and didn't relent. For Cormac, it was as if the Irish storm that killed so many people and crops and horses had made its way across the Atlantic. The North River was frozen solid all the way to Poughkeepsie, almost 80 miles. But in some way, the brutal New York cold and his memories of Ireland combined to revive his own search for the man who had brought him here. In Cormac's free time, he looked with renewed passion for the Earl of Warren.
And then, on the day before Christmas, after dropping some printed notices at the Lutheran church, which stood then a block south of Trinity, he turned into Wall Street, and there he was. The Earl. Getting into a cream-colored carriage in front of City Hall. Cormac's heart jumped. He went after the cream-colored carriage, thinking, I could catch him and kill him, but not without a sword. Thinking, I must know where he goes, must know where he lives. And then the carriage picked up speed. It was too fast. It didn't pause at any of the wharves and rolled north. Cormac watched it vanish over the ridge and the frozen stream that spilled from the common, thinking, He's here. The Earl is here. Early Christmas morning, while the sky remained blue with night, Cormac rose early, dressed warmly, and hurried out to find Congo. He found him in the backyard of Guilfoyle the Builder. Congo and Quacko were feeding a fire with scrap wood.
How is it you not in the big church with all the other wonderful Christians? Quacko said.
I'd rather be here, Cormac said.
I need to talk to the Babalawo.
He gestured for Congo to step aside and speak to him alone. Congo excused himself to Quacko and walked with Cormac to the dark side of a shed.
Yes, Congo said. I need your help. I have to find a man named the Earl of Warren. Last year in Ireland, he caused my father to be shot dead, and in our tribe the son must avenge the father.
In my tribe too.
Yesterday, at last, I saw him. He went north in a coach, but I couldn't follow in the snow and ice.
You want him dead?
Yes, but I'm the only one who can do it. I hope that somehow you and your friends can find him for me.
He showed Congo a folded drawing he'd made of the Earl. The African glanced at the drawing and slipped it inside his coat.
I'll look. If he on this island, we find him.
Then after a long silence, Congo said,
Something big to happen, as soon as winter ends. It's about us, the Africans and the Irish, and the fleets of Spain. Say nothing, but know that the gods know. The gods say yes.
Then Congo turned and hurried back to Quacko and the fire. In the solitude of the night, Cormac tried to sort out the separate boxes of his life. He told himself that he must arrange them as if his mind was a type case. The largest letters were in the top drawer. They spelled out the name of the Earl and his presence in New York and Cormac's hope that Congo's men would find him. In the drawer below was Mary Burden. She scared him in some ways because she lived most completely in the future, in some glorious place where she was free. He could imagine no future until he had rid himself of the pursuit of the Earl. And he felt, too, the thrilling pressure of the conspiracy that was building in the town. He wanted Mary Burton to be free, but he wanted Congo to be free, too, and Quacko, and Quacko's wife serving in the fort, and all the others. And so he volunteered his name to the conspiracy. Congo accepted him with a dubious look in his eyes.
You help with words, he said. With printed words, not with gun or torch.
Cormac learned that Congo had found instant allies in 6 Spanish blacks. They were free men under the flag of Spain, working for pay on a ship captured by an English privateer named John Lush. Because the English crown insisted that anyone black was automatically a slave, Lush could sell them as if they were captured horses. Cormac didn't mention the contact between Congo and the Spanish blacks to Mr. Partridge, who would have understood that the Spanish blacks could serve as messengers to the fleets of Spain. He also learned that the arrival of Congo had made the Africans believe that a rising could be victorious. Quacko told him all of this. Now Cormac finally understood the meaning of Babalawo.
Prince of spirits, Quacko said. Congo speak to gods, and they speak through him. He can lead us all to freedom. My people, you people, Irish people.
The plan was emerging. If the African and Irish rebels could wound the English forces in New York, if they could seize arms, if they could panic the civilian population, then Spain could take the city with a handful of ships. And one February night, Cormac went to Hewson's at the invitation of Quacko. Irishmen and Africans arrived. On this night, at Congo's order, there would be neither porter nor strong liquor. Mary Burton, Sarah Hewson, and Peggy were absent. Finally, Hewson tapped a spoon on the side of a metal tankard, and the room hushed.
"Hear ye, hear ye. We've met here often as friends. Tonight we meet as allies. All here share a common condition, the lack of freedom. Many of you are slaves, many are indentured servants. We believe it's time to do something about it."
"Like what?"
someone shouted. Cormac thought, "Like freeing Mary Burton."
"This is neither the time nor the place to discuss details," Hewson said. "The bloody British are masters of bribery, of informing, of spies. As far as you Irish are concerned, wait for word from us, from the High Command. We'll be in touch as the hour draws near."
Congo nodded at Cormac, placed fingers to his mouth, indicating they would speak later, and then went with his men out the back door into the falling snow. Mary Burton was nowhere in sight, and after a while Cormac went out the back door to piss against a wall. Then heard his name. Mary Burton was at a top-floor window, her hair wild, a shawl upon her shoulders and neck.
"Be careful of that lot inside," she said. "They're going to cause a lot of trouble. Wait there."
In a few minutes she arrived at his side. They embraced, and he could feel the warmth coming from her body.
"You must be wary," she said. "I've heard John Hewson talking to his brother, a thieving lecher from Poughkeepsie, and what he's saying here is not what he's saying to his brother."
"What is it they're saying?"
"It depends on how much drink is taken. Sometimes he brags that he'll soon be King of New York. Then he's to be a viceroy for the Spanish crown. Or he'll make a separate peace with the British, betray everybody, have them all hanged or burned, and then get the British to make him a lord and become governor. Whatever the feck it is, it'll be for to serve John Hewson, not the Africans or the Irish or anyone else."
With that, she brushed his face with her lips and went to the back door and was gone. For 2 days, Cormac searched for Congo. He must be warned. They all must be warned about the slippery secrets of John Hewson. Then early one Sunday morning, after another heavy snowfall, he saw Congo in the yard behind the print shop. He was holding the reins of a horse.
"I want to show you something," Congo said. "Come."
Cormac climbed on the horse's back directly behind Congo and began telling him what he had heard about John Hewson.
"Don't trust him," Cormac said.
"We don't. He thinks he is using us, all of us, but we are using him."
They rode north for hours, avoiding anyone who might be alarmed by an African and a white man sharing a horse. They came to a small road cutting away to the west through the Bloomingdale properties, a section where virgin forest stood like walls protecting cleared land, now brilliant with snow. Congo was cautious, alert. He slowed the horse and stopped and pointed. Off in the distance, on a cliff above the river, was the house of the Earl of Warren. Cormac knew it belonged to the Earl because from that distance it was an exact duplicate of the ruined house in Ireland. They moved closer. Just inside the stable doors was the cream-colored carriage. On the great porch of the house facing inland, its back to the river, two white men moved back and forth on the steps. One held a musket. Cormac longed for his sword, but saw that the Earl had defended himself against any sort of direct assault. What had happened in Ireland would not happen here. Only a fool would charge this small fortress alone.
"This is the place you were looking for," Congo said.
"This is the place."
"Good. We come back."
For months, the Earl had existed for the young man as a kind of ghost, a specter made of anger and memory, and now he was everywhere. Cormac saw the Earl walking through the empty square of the slave market. He saw him on another day leaving the expensive shop of Edwards the bootmaker. Cormac related news of his sightings to Mr. Partridge, who urged the young man to be careful.
"This Earl, such men have power. The power of money, of a willingness to hurt others. Once they get power, they'll do anything to preserve it. Watch yourself, lad. Do nothing rash."
Mr. Partridge retired early, hauling his weary bones to the second floor. Cormac lay down to sleep, glancing out at the falling snow. Then he heard a soft knock at the back door. He took a candle in one hand and the sword in the other and opened the door an inch. Mary Burton stood there, shivering in the cold.
"I've come to warn you, Cormac," she said. "It's about to happen."
"Come in, Mary."
She shook the snow off her shawl and sat on the edge of the fireplace. The rising would begin on St. Patrick's night, 5 days hence. The fort would be set afire, Quacko's wife liberated, the armory looted of guns, which would then be dispersed to the rebels. There was a list of good masters and bad. The loot would be taken to the brewery building at the foot of Stone Street. Then John Hewson's brother would cart everything away in a sloop to exchange it upstate for more guns. While the fort was burning, certain whites would be attacked and, if necessary, killed. Many buildings would be torched, and the Spanish fleet would then sweep into the town.
"We've got to leave this place," she said. "It will be like the fires of hell."
"I can't do that, Mary. I'm obliged in other ways."
"You're fecking obliged? I'll be going then. What happens to you will be none of my business, and don't be looking for me in Hewson's, for I'll be gone. With me child."
She hurried out into the snow. Cormac grabbed a coat to go after her, but she was gone. He stood there, his body trembling, but not from the cold.
"She says she's carrying a child. Her child. But my child, too. And in her rage, she might become what everyone in the Irish tribe hated above all living creatures. An informer."
He should warn Congo, tell him of the danger. And then he felt a great pity for Mary Burton. He addressed explanations to her, ones he should have made and still might make this snowy night.
"You see," he told the absent Mary Burton, "there's something I must do first, something that comes before my own life and your life and the life of any unborn child. Something I must do, because if I don't do it, if I don't avenge the murder of my father, I can never be free. My vow comes before Congo, too, and before the rising. It comes before everything."
Then, just past the door, he could see a lean, coarse-skinned man peering through the glass. Cormac unlatched the door.
"I need a broadside," he said. "Quickly."
"We're closed, sir."
The man exhaled in an exasperated way.
"Make an exception. This is for a ship arriving in a week's time. We need 200 posters no later than St. Patrick's Day."
He fumbled in his jacket for a sheet bearing the copy, explaining that the bark was named the Valiant, carrying a consignment of raw sugar, rum, and 36 seasoned slaves, the first ship in 2.5 months. Politely, Cormac tried to explain that the Partridge Shop didn't do slaving business, but they could handle the sugar and the rum.
"Well, in that case, I'll have to discuss it with the Earl."
Cormac's heart skipped several beats.
"Which Earl's that, sir?"